So hey, everybody, welcome to Skype a Scientist Live. It's Antibiotic Resistance Week, which is interesting during a viral pandemic, but we still got to talk about it because it's still a big thing that we have to think about, worry about, study. Today, we are joined by Harvard professor, Dr. Michael Baim. We are super excited to have him here. Get all of your questions ready. If you have questions while he's going through a few slides, please submit them in the Q&A function below, and we'll try to get to as many questions as we possibly can during this session. So at this point, would you like to introduce yourself, say who you are, what you do, why you like it, and then we'll give you the stage to go over what you have to show us today.
Sure. I'm Michael Baim. I'm originally a mathematician from Illinois, but I decided, well, I learned about antibiotic resistance about 10, 15 years ago and have been absolutely fascinated with it ever since. And actually became a microbiologist and changed fields. And now I run a lab at Harvard where we study that using a combination of computers and also hands-on experiments. I don't know, what else should I say, Sarah?
That sounds great. You've given us an origin story and why do you like what you do?
Microbes, you know, we always think in basic biology, these small creatures are so simple. And, human biology is so complicated, and these small creatures, they're simple biology. And yet, I feel like the more we look at them, the less we understand.
That's for sure true.
And there's just always mysteries. But then also, it lets us actually study evolution. Because animals, will take 5, 10, 30 years between generations. And so in your lifetime, you can't really study how animals change.
Right.
But bacteria, it takes 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And so, we can reproduce what would have been a 1,000 years of human evolution or 100,000 years of human evolution in a matter of weeks.
That's super powerful and so cool.
And so then we can actually say, we can actually look at things we think we know about evolution and say, can we actually see those happen in the lab? And can we test it? What happens if we change things? What happens if we turn back history and rerun the clock? Mm-hmm. So I feel like there are just endless things to be discovered.
That's awesome. I think you've touched on something really universal in biology, that the more we study things, the more we realize that nothing is as simple as we thought it was. And there's so much we don't know. That's, I feel like something that a lot of our scientists kind of touch on, the more you know, the more you know that we don't know,
I mean, when I was in elementary school and high school, I was taught that there were two domains of life. This was considered one of the most fundamental facts of biology. There's eukaryotes and prokaryotes. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that's actually not true. There are three.
Right.
There's
right.
Also the archaea, which are much more closely related to eukaryotes than bacteria, but because they looked like bacteria, they were lumped in with bacteria for a very, very long time.
Right.
And it was only, when we looked even closer that we realized this thing that was taught as so central to biology was actually not true.
Right, yeah.
And then the more I learn about microbes, the more you learn they're everywhere.
Yeah.
That they're, I remember a talk that was really influential. The speaker showed a picture of Yosemite, one of these big, beautiful cliffs at Yosemite with this large black line down it. And then he said that, that black line, that's not actually a different type of rock. In that particular black line, there's a little bit of water and a little more sunlight, And that's actually microbes growing all the way up the surface. So big you can see it. So at that point I was hooked.
Awesome. That's awesome. Cool. So do you have anything that you'd like to, like any slides you'd like to share with us today?
Yeah, I have a couple short slides sort of introducing some of the things that I've done.
And then from there, we'll go into all our questions coming in from the audience.
But Sarah, maybe while I'm going through the slides, if you could make it interactive, I think that'd be, if you have questions or want to say things, like, I think that would make it more fun for everyone.
That sounds great.
Included.
Okay.
So let me see if I can get that share started.
Cool.
All right, so all of you should be able to see this graphic from the WHO from today. So every week, the World Health Organization has World Antimicrobial Awareness Week. And this is meant to draw attention to this problem of antibiotic resistance that some of you have probably heard of. But before we talk about antibiotic resistance, we should talk about antibiotics. And before we talk about antibiotics, we need to talk a little bit about bacteria. So the most important thing that you should know about bacteria, the most important thing about them, is that they're very, very small. So I'm going to show you some pictures largely made by a former graduate student, Joy Zhao. So this gives you a sense. That thing on the left is to scale a human skin cell versus E. coli. So the cells of your skin that are too small for you to see, the E. coli is even smaller compared to that, and they're everywhere. They're all through the soil, they're all over your body. The estimates are there are as many bacterial cells on and in your body as there are human cells. There are some people who like to say that you're as much bacterial as you are human. I'm not sure that's totally how I feel about it, but it gives you a sense of just how many bacteria there are. Now, you might be asking, well, if there's so many bacteria, why aren't we sick all the time? And one of the really interesting ideas is that actually many bacteria are helpful. Most don't really care who or what you are. They've been around much longer than we have, but some of them actually are helpful. Certain bacteria on your skin prevent other bacteria that could hurt you from infecting you. Certain bacteria in your gut seem to be really important to health. But of course, there are the ones that everyone's heard about, which are the dangerous ones. I'm showing you these because these are some very scary looking electron micrographs of bacteria. But in fact, when you think about what's happening in the world, pandemics like this have been a part of human history since humans have been humans. And they've been sort of a mix of viruses and bacteria. And in fact, probably the most famous plague ever, one of the ones that impacted the course of humanity the most, was the plague, which was in fact a bacterial pathogen. And for most of human history, bacteria were so threatening, you could fall down and skin your knee and get an infection and lose your leg. This was relatively common. And for most of human history, infectious disease caused about 40% of all mortality. It's now down to about 8%. So one of the most important things that happened was this Scottish scientist, Alexander Fleming, in 1928, who was trying to understand how bacteria worked and had a stack of petri dishes where he was growing bacteria and put them in the side of his lab, and then went on a long vacation for the weekend. And when he came back, he found one of the most important examples of sort of accidental discovery, I think, in all of, certainly all of scientific history, which was this plate. Now, what are we looking at here? So up here, these are Staph aureus, which is a bacteria that can infect your skin, growing normally. But he noticed that near that white blob at the bottom, they were growing more slowly. And it turns out that bacteria, that white blob at the bottom, was a fungus producing what is now called penicillin. And this revolutionized medicine. Antibiotics are used for all sorts of things. You know, again, when I was growing up, one of the things we were taught was viral infections are a problem, but bacterial infections have basically been solved by antibiotics. Unfortunately, that's becoming less and less true.
Right.
So now, you know, while most bacterial infections still respond, more and more they don't. And people are getting quite upset about this. So let's talk about what antibiotic resistance is. And there's a very important idea that I need to introduce, which is this concept that enough of anything is lethal. So too much water is lethal. Too much milk is lethal. You know, the real question of how poisonous is something is how much of it is poisonous. And so you see this sort of green arrow indicating that at a very low amount of some chemical, the little yellow bacterium is and the person are both happy. And once you get to a high enough level, they both can't stand it. And what an antibiotic is it's some chemical where there's some dosage in the middle where the bacterium cannot survive, but the human can survive. So penicillin, you know, is hundreds of times more toxic to bacteria than it is to people. So if you can give someone the right amount of penicillin, you can kill the bacteria and not hurt the person. What antibiotic resistance is when that bacterium changes, not the person, when the bacterium changes so that now it can survive as much as the human can survive. And so you can no longer give that drug to a person without hurting them and still kill the bacterium. And there are two ways that this happens. There's spontaneous mutation. So sometimes they'll just mutate and become more resistant. And that's what I'm going to show you a video of in a few minutes. And then the other way of doing it, the other way they become resistant, which I'm not going to talk about, or at least not going to tell you much of the science today, though we can talk about it later, Sarah, if you want, is gene sharing. So one bacterium can have a gene that gives it antibiotic resistance, and it can literally give that gene to another bacterium. And so then once you have this mutant in a population, it starts out by being rare. But then what happens? Well, you give antibiotics to that population, and now everything except for that mutant is killed. And now that mutant's really, really happy because it has all these nutrients around and all of its competition's dead. So now it spreads out and takes over. And now if you use antibiotics again, nothing happens. So I want to show you a video I made of this. This was work a few years back with Tammy Lieberman, Remy Chait, and Roy Kishoni, who are now all faculty at MIT, Exeter, and the Technion. This is, we were all in Roy's lab at the time. And this is a picture of us actually trying to build a device to study this. The device was basically a petri dish. This is what scientists in the laboratory use to study bacteria. It's essentially just a small dish with some gel in it, but a really, really big one. So it's 2 feet by 4 feet. That's, I can't actually move my hands far enough out in the video to demonstrate it, but it's big. And we set it up in this very special way with 2 different layers of food for the bacteria, one that they could swim around in on top and one that they couldn't on the bottom. And on the bottom, that had different amounts of antibiotic. And so when we poured it in these sections and then poured the top on it, we created an environment where the bacteria could move around to wherever they were happy. And, you know, it's nice enough that it's big, so we just have this camera in the ceiling to take videos or to take pictures and assemble a time-lapse movie. And we set it up like this giant football field, except instead of trying to get to the end zones, the E. coli that are on the outside are trying to get to the center. But there's a big barrier in the way. There's basically a mountain of antibiotics. So in that outermost section, there's no antibiotic, so they're going to spread out. And then there's just more than they can survive, 10 times as much as that, 100 times as much of that, and 1,000 times as much of that. And what I did with the camera is set it so that it took a photograph every 10 minutes. And then I put them together as a movie. And the movie is playing at a speed where every 1 second of this movie is about 4 hours. Or the movie itself is about 11 days or 12 days total. And the other thing you need to know is that the E. coli are white and the medium behind it is black. So the first thing you see is these white E. coli spreading all the way up to the boundary. And then they stop because there's antibiotics until this mutant shows up. And this has a mutation that lets it survive a little more, but not 10 times more. You'll see it'll stop in a few seconds right here. But then other mutants from that first mutant make it even further. And what you're watching when you see with this is literally a video of evolution happening. This is mutation and selection repeated and repeated. And in 11 days, it makes it into the center. Now you might ask, well, why'd you stop there? Why not put 10,000 times as much? And the answer is actually chemistry, that it's impossible to put more than about this much drug into the medium without using chemicals that are more deadly to dissolve it. So.
That is so cool. I think this is like one of literally the best visualizations of evolution I've ever seen. And I spend my whole time in science communication land. So this is like my favorite thing that's ever been created.
Thank you.
It's so, so cool. So.
It really means a lot. So maybe I'll stop there and we can move to questions.
Sure, that sounds great. I have one question before we launch into the audience questions. So bacterial genomes, like so all the DNA that's in a bacterium, there's not that much of it compared to what's in an animal like us. So how much, like did you compare the genes that changed between those bacteria that lived in that center slice versus who was hanging out at the beginning?
Yeah, actually we did. And I made a spare slide on this just in case you asked, Sarah.
Great.
So one of the great things about it is you can actually sample from it when it's done. Mm-hmm. So unlike a lot of evolution, the paths that didn't make it don't go away.
Right.
And so we were able to take all of these samples and then using the movie trace time backwards to construct lineages and figure out where everything came from. And then we were able to take those isolates and look at their genomes and compare them and find out which genes changed, which ones didn't. It turned out to be fairly complicated. It wasn't one mutation. It was a set of quite a few different ones. And there were some really interesting things happening in there that in retrospect make a lot of sense, but were kind of a surprise when we first saw them.
That's super cool. Amazing. Okay. So
one of the bacteria over here, it's actually evolved the ability to mutate faster. So when you first look at all these mutations, this one had, you know, many of these have 5 or 6 mutations. This one has like 200.
Oh my God.
Right. I saw this and I thought, I'm never going to make sense of this. And then we realized it's a mutator.
Right.
So
Awesome. Super cool. Also, one of our teachers just said to us, this is your experiment. I showed this to my students. So apparently it's made the rounds. That's amazing. Okay, so the first question we have is from Brielle. And Brielle wants to know, what is the worst sickness that you've come across?
The worst sickness I've come across. I mean, I have to start by saying I'm the wrong person to ask about that.
Right.
I'm not a medical doctor. I'm a laboratory scientist. So I have incredible respect for medical doctors, but really I deal with the bacteria themselves without really looking at the person.
Right.
So, you know, I think the worst sickness I've come across is the same as things everyone else have come across.
Right.
Cancer, heart disease.
Yeah. I think that's an important distinction to make because a lot of times people think, for example, as somebody studying antibiotic resistance, that you see the whole thing. You see from like from the bacteria side all the way to the patient. And really scientists are focusing on really, really specific things. And so like, even as a squid biologist, I studied like how bacteria and squid talk to each other. But if you ask me how squid, you know, digest their food, I don't really know much about that. And I'm like a squid expert. So it's like, it's amazing how specialized scientists often become. Gavin wants to know.
But this is how, this is how we make progress because, absolutely. You know, to really move something forward, you have to really understand it.
Right.
And there are a lot of things to understand. And there's only so much one person or one lab of people can understand in enough detail to really make progress.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think there's this perception that scientists are these like ultra geniuses, but really we just know a lot about one specific area. And it's not like an ultra genius amount of information because humans can't, and that's okay. You know? Yeah.
Cool. Like I know nothing about squids.
See, yeah.
I think they're really cool.
They are really cool. That's one thing we can all agree on. Squid are really cool. There are a lot of great questions in here. So let's see. So Khalid wants to know, does this mean that by the end of your experiment, you ended up with a new strain of bacteria?
So this is actually a more contentious question than you think. Because it comes down to what is the definition of a strain of bacteria? And I think that's something that honestly people don't agree on. I mean, if the way you're defining a strain is, well, what's it resistant to? What can kill it and what can't? Then yeah. So, I mean, one of the difficulties is concepts that seem so cut and dry, like species and strain and genus, the closer you look at them, the less sense they actually make. One of the big debates is what is a bacterial species? What does species even mean? Or do we even need species as a definition? Do we need it as a, do we even need to think about species? So
that is, especially with bacteria, that is a hairy question for sure. The next question is from Ava. What's it like having a lab at Harvard?
It is so much fun. It is, you know, the best part about it is I get to work with these incredible scientists every single day. And we get to go into the lab and in the way that we think is best, we get to explore the world together. And I mean, it's more fun than I could have ever imagined.
That's really great to hear.
You know, there's paperwork and bureaucracy, like in every job, but the science of it and that part of it is better than I could have ever hoped.
Awesome, thank you. Caitlin wants to know, what behaviors could we engage in to help mitigate the rise of antibiotic resistance?
That's a great, great question. One of the most important things you can do. So something you saw in that video is that antibiotic resistance fundamentally comes from antibiotics. It comes from bacteria seeing antibiotics and figuring out a way around them. And when there are a lot of things that antibiotics are given for, or that people want antibiotics for, where they're not needed. You know, for a cold or for a flu, something that's a virus, antibiotics often don't, I mean, they don't really help. They don't do anything to a virus. And so one of the most important things that can be done is just not giving antibiotics when they're not needed. You know, if you have a viral infection, don't take antibiotics for it. You know, just because you're sick, just because you have a fever, you know, ask your doctor, like, is this a bacteria or a virus? Because if it's a virus, you know, don't take antibiotics. That's probably the single most effective thing that's been shown to reduce the rate of antibiotic resistance, is just stopping using them in cases where they don't do anything.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's really, really important. So then kind of like a related question to that, are you worried about the increased use of hand sanitizer or antibiotic soaps during COVID, but also like in the last, let's say, 20 years?
No, I'm not.
Good.
Because the antibiotic resistant soaps, or the antibiotic, you know, the hand sanitizers that we're using, they also kill bacteria, but they kill them with ethanol, with alcohol, and with a lot of it. You know, this hand sanitizer, Purell, is 60% or 70% ethyl alcohol. You can't give that to a patient to cure an infection. That will kill them before it kills the bacterium.
Right.
And so even if they develop resistance, so there is a bit of resistance to sanitizers that's been observed, but nowhere near 60%. It's not clear that it's biologically possible to evolve full resistance to sanitizers like that. And that resistance doesn't translate to antibiotic resistance. You know, because ethanol and penicillin are very different chemicals and they act very differently.
Awesome. Well, that
so
is
no, I'm not worried great. About.
So we should keep sanitizing our hands, particularly during a pandemic.
I'm a little worried about antibiotics in soap and in toothpaste.
Toothpaste, no.
Although, yeah, I don't think it's as common anymore, but there used to be triclosan in a lot of toothpastes, which is a very powerful disinfectant. But that's becoming less and less common.
Good to
know. For exactly this reason.
Right, yeah. The next question, okay, so this is kind of related to a previous question. So you went through this experiment, you ended up at the end with some pretty tough bacteria that could handle a lot of antibiotics. So in a sense, you've kind of like created a monster in the lab. Like, how do you get rid of that bacteria?
Bleach. Lots of bleach.
Awesome.
But also, you could use other antibiotics.
Right.
You know, there's not just one. So the antibiotic we used in this experiment is called trimethoprim. But we still could have used penicillin or ciprofloxacin or kanamycin. You know, there are many different antibiotics that one can use. And just because it's really resistant to one doesn't mean there isn't another that would work.
Right.
Actually, this is one of the essential areas of research of my lab, is trying to see if someone is sick, how can we very quickly figure out what antibiotics will work and which will not?
Cool.
So that a doctor can give them the right antibiotic the first time.
So if like a person is sick with an infection that maybe didn't work for the first set of antibiotics, you take a sample from the patient, you hit that bacterium with a bunch of different types of antibiotic, and then you go back to the doctor and say, this is what's going to work for this patient?
I want it even faster than that. I want you. I want a patient to come in when they're sick. The doctor takes a swab of their mouth, sticks it in a box on the wall, and 20 minutes later gets a little printout that says, here's what'll work and here's what won't.
Cool. So how the heck do you do that?
Well, so right now it's science fiction.
Okay. But
the way that we're trying to do is DNA sequencing. So all of these rapid, so it's using some of actually very similar techniques to what's being used for COVID tests.
Oh.
To extract the DNA, extract the genomes, amplify them up, and then read all of it really, really quickly. And from that, try to figure out what will work and what won't.
Cool. So like your speed 23andMe-ing your own infection, kind of.
Yeah.
Cool. Awesome. That's awesome.
Now getting it down even below 8 hours is a big technical challenge, but I think we'll be able to do 20 minutes at some point.
I have faith in you. If anybody can do it, it's you. That's great. Good luck. All right, Brielle wants to know, what is your favorite type of bacteria and your least favorite type of bacteria?
This is like asking me to choose between kids. My favorite kind of bacteria. Probably Streptomyces. Streptomyces are, they're a weird bacterium. People thought for a long time they were a fungus. So for those of you who know any Greek, the myces on the end of them is a suffix that means fungus because they thought it was a fungus. But they're actually bacteria and they grow in the dirt. And Streptomyces are very interesting because they actually produce most antibiotics that we know of to fight other bacteria, or potentially to fight other bacteria, we're not sure. But the other thing that they do, which is very lovely, is they produce a chemical called geosmin, which you probably know as the smell of dirt after the rain. And my least favorite, I really didn't like that one strain of bacillus that kept contaminating the megaplate. I got very angry at it. So, but it wasn't its fault.
It's just living its life, you know?
Yeah.
Its approach.
It's hard. But
when it affects
it's hard to be mad at them.
Yeah, I totally get that. That's awesome. Okay, the next question is from Ava. So as a person who gets bored really fast and always wants to try a new thing all the time, how are you able to stay so dedicated to your work in your field of study?
This actually is a question that hits closer to home than you probably thought. So I have always been someone who gets distracted very quickly and always jumps from interest to interest and can't really stick on one thing. And this is part of why, you know, I was a mathematician and then I was a computer scientist and now I'm a microbiologist and maybe an engineer. I think the best advice that I ever got was somebody said, trust the shape of your interests. Trust what you think is interesting, because that's a common thread. And even if you don't know what the shape of your interest is, there is a shape, and trust that it exists and follow it. And I've sort of been taking this to heart and just, you know, every time I've had, well, I could work on this that's important or this that's interesting, it's always the interesting one that ends up becoming much more important.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially when it's hard to predict what's going to be important before you really dig in. And so, yeah, I've had a similar path of just like, well, this is interesting right now. And I suddenly have a lot of energy for this problem. So let's just kind of see where it goes. And that's pretty much how this entire Skype a Scientist program exists at all, because I followed what was interesting.
But yeah, Ava, I would recommend just keep pushing. You know, this is still a challenge for me to this day, but a challenge like that doesn't need to define you. You know, when I took one of these, what career should you have tests based on my personality, it said, because I was always distracted, I should consider, you know, maybe being a park ranger, which I didn't want to be. And at the very bottom of the list was scientist. But I think I'm doing okay as a scientist. So I don't think those tests necessarily mean that much. You know, don't let it define you. Do what you want to do. And
yeah, that is solid advice. Yeah. Thank you. The next question is from Elizabeth. So you have a mutated bacteria that in this case mutated to be able to handle antibiotics, but are there ever cases where a bacterium that might make a person sick mutates away from the like nasty, like disease causing gene or what have you that would then end up making it not that bad?
Yeah, that happens all the time. And actually a really exciting area of research is how do you encourage them to lose that? How do you take this thing that happens and give them a little nudge? You know, how do we find a way to, instead of directly killing bacteria, just make them not so bad?
Cool. Let's see. So there are so many questions. Let's see. So do you know generally why doctors will still give you antibiotics even though they know it won't fix it? Like why this still continues to be a practice?
Because usually it does. And usually it's not a problem. You know, one of the real issues is almost every time a doctor gives antibiotics unnecessarily, nothing happens.
Right.
You know, it only encourages resistance 1 in 1,000 times, 1 in 100,000 times. And so an individual doctor may never see in their career a single time that there's actually a negative consequence from giving an antibiotic unnecessarily.
Right.
On the other hand, if you need an antibiotic, it's a miracle drug. You know, these infections that would have cost you your leg or even killed you 60 years ago or 80 years ago, you know, now you take a couple pills and 24 hours later, you're back at school.
Right. Yeah.
And I mean, when you need them, you know, when I need antibiotics, when I have an infection that needs antibiotics, I take them for sure.
Yeah.
You know, there's, so I think it's just a very difficult thing to convince someone that this rare event that they may never see on the scale of an entire society will make a difference.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Cool. The next question is from Matthew. After a bacteria mutates, will it always keep that mutation or will it revert back to what it used to be if it's no longer exposed to the antibiotics?
So I have to give you the most biology answer, which is sometimes yes, sometimes no.
Right.
In general, once a bacterium gets a mutation, then you know it may get other mutations, but the chance that the next mutation it gets is losing that first mutation, that's actually pretty rare. And in the experiments we've done on, for example, the isolates from the megaplate, you can keep growing them without antibiotic for a long time and they just keep resistance.
In my lab work, so one thing that this might be like too much in the weeds, but there's a difference, right, between whether like the mutation, and maybe a lot of times for scientists, like we put a mutation there to make it do something, make the lab bacteria do something we want it to do. There's like the main genome, and then there's these other little chunks of DNA we can toss in there. And those little chunks that don't get incorporated into the big hula hoop of DNA will just like get kicked out at the slightest inconvenience from the bacterium. And so maybe in my lab, we made bacteria go.
But once you get that gene into the genome,
then it's like
really hard to get it out.
Right, right. And so these antibiotic resistance genes, they're in the main genome, right? And so they're pretty tough.
Sometimes.
Oh, not always. Okay. Oh, yeah, that's true.
Not always. Sometimes they can be on plasmids. Uh-huh. But those plasmids, you know, while bacteria can kick them out, the plasmids actually don't want to be kicked out. And so often they'll have what are called addiction systems. Huh. That the plasmid, even though it may not be helping the bacterium, will have some system in it so that if the bacterium kicks it out, it'll kill the bacteria. Okay. So bacteria, once they get the plasmid, cannot get rid of it.
Huh. Well, that's tricky. That's cool.
Yeah. And the more you get into it, and then there are viruses that target those, and everything that, every pathogen has a pathogen, or every parasite has a parasite.
Right, yeah, cool. All right, so we try to keep these sessions to be about 45 minutes long, and we are rapidly approaching that time. Although we still have a lot of questions that people have asked. So we always ask everybody the same two questions at the end of every session. And the first question is, if you had everyone's attention in the whole world and you could tell them one thing about your area of expertise, what would that be?
Don't use antibiotics when you don't have to, because they'll run out.
Awesome, great advice. And the second question is somewhat related. If you still have everybody's attention in the world, but you can tell them anything about anything, it can be as big picture, significant, important, or like silly and small as you'd like. It doesn't have to be related to your work. What would that be?
So probably if you gave me more time, I'd come up with something else. But the thing that popped into my head is this little eukaryotic single cell bug called Oxytricha triflex. And I think this is one of the weirdest. You were asking what my favorite bacterium was. If you asked me my favorite microbe, this would be it.
Okay.
Because this thing, you know, we normally think of things as having DNA and having a genome. Uh-huh. And this has a genome. And then it also has these microgenomes where basically it takes its genome and it chops it up into like 10,000 pieces. And it's just totally fine like this. And then when it comes time to duplicate, it sort of reassembles those, duplicates, and then splits them up again.
But not in like chromosomes, it's just like in chunks.
I think they're called microchromosomes. We're getting outside of my area here. I just think this is like
super cool.
And I think what this illustrates is really this idea that, you know, there are so many things we think we know.
Right.
And we think are conventional wisdom. And then we look closer and there's an exception. And it doesn't, you know, this sort of says this basic understanding of how DNA replicates, how DNA codes for organisms, how heredity works, that very basic understanding of that, it doesn't always work that way.
Right. You can never make like one definitive statement in biology. It's like most of the time, this is how we think it works, but there's always going to be, the deeper you look, there's always going to be an exception to every rule. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today.
Thanks, Sarah. This was fun.
This was really fun. Do you have anything that you'd like to plug, anywhere that we can find you on social media or anywhere like that?
You can find me on social media, on Twitter, in my last name. The lab has a website, but No, not so much. Not right now. I mean, I think what you're doing with Skype a Scientist is fantastic. And I'm really excited to be here and to support that.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being with us. This was awesome. Just so everybody knows, we have another antibiotic resistance session on Friday at 1 p.m. We'll be focusing on something a little bit different. We're going to be focusing on how we can find antibiotics and new antibiotics in our environment, even like in our backyards, in the soil, all over the place. There are so many antibiotics that exist in nature that we just haven't accessed yet. And so Dr. Nicole Broderick will be talking with us all about that and a class that she organizes that helps undergrads work toward that process. So that's gonna be super fun. We hope to see you all there. Erin, thank you for signing for us. As always, we really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Michael, thank you for enlightening us on this topic. This was so fun. So yeah,
thanks, thank Sarah.
You. All right, bye everybody.
Bye.